Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I would say that today is as foggy a day as any we had in London town.
But we still had a great view.
We did.
So it's really, I guess you sort of get used to the haziness.
That's
out there. But we have been to this, the home of our first interview guest today. We've actually been there before when the sun was shining. And you could see for miles and miles
and miles.
It's such
a cool place. I mean, it is really a cool place. And of course we saw it decorated for Christmas, which was, it was a dreamscape, the whole dining room.
Yeah, but the thrilling thing was the food on the plate.
Oh, every single thing better than the
what did we call it? I called it magnificent.
Yes, well that's
so good. Miraculous would be another way of describing it. Claudio Cardozo is
genius.
He's a polyglot. Polyglot when it comes to ethnic background.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. I still have it exactly straight, but it's mostly Portuguese. But that sure doesn't seem like that's what's on your plate. but it's such a fun experience to talk to such a thoughtful young man.
Yes, he's wonderful, and I would highly recommend Sushi Samba to anybody who's in London.
We
have yet to go to the one in New York, which we need to do.
It happens, by the way, to be the highest restaurant in London.
Is it really?
One of the that's what they say. They say there are people who've built restaurants that they pretend are higher, but in fact this one's on the 40th floor of a building called the Heron Tower. And it's really kind of amazing for Peter, who started his career working in the city of London when the tallest building was about six stories tall. and now there's more than one building that's more than 40 stories tall. But let's get on with it. Here's Claudio Cardozo, one of the world's great chefs.
I'm actually very much in love with Sushi Samba. And if, in fact, I lived in London, I would be here all the time, I think. I also have a soft spot in my heart for the chef, Claudio Cardozo, who is, you're a gentle man, and you don't seem very excitable. Is that true?
if I'm not very excitable. I guess it's my type of personality. Like I'm observate, I analyze, and I don't know. I get excited about things, but maybe I don't show them. I'm just very like calm with my own way of being, and I guess that's the way I am, you know.
Well, I think from your background, you were probably predisposed to explore a variety of cultures, absorb influences from all over the world. You are, in fact. Your mother was South African, your father Portuguese, and the Portuguese were explorers, and they influenced the world, and the world influenced them. Do you think it's a natural bent you have? Do you have a restaurant with so many influences, including mainly, I think you would say, the Peruvian? And what would you say, the Japanese, the Peruvian, and also Brazilian?
We can say that. I always say, like, when you're a chef at this level and you cooked in so many different cuisines and you absorb so many different cultures, you end up knowing a bit more than only one food culture in the end, you know? My background is a bit more Portuguese than anything else, but it's curious that it's been the only food that I never actually cooked in a restaurant. I never had the opportunity to have a restaurant where I would cook Portuguese food. I was head chef of a very famous and good Italian restaurant, for example, in the Ritz-Carlton. I worked in Lebanese restaurants, Chinese restaurants, Iraqi restaurants, and so on. Always believe that we learn a way of cooking and a technique and a culture, which is the chef culture. And then I think each culture, then we just have to adapt. Obviously, I am not Japanese and I don't cook to the perfection of a Japanese. I cook to a perfection of a Portuguese. So if I had to cook something that would be like really would be Portuguese food, but I can do any other food, a lot of molecular cuisine, a lot of research, a lot of scientific background on food as well, because I still believe that that's what is more up to date. And that's why we kind of have to keep always researching on what's coming up and what's trendy and what is the new products. And that's what people are looking for as well, new exciting things, you know.
Yeah, new cells. but, you know, a while ago, you were very supportive of molecular gastronomy, or molecular, whatever you want to call it. Nobody likes that word. But the influence of it has sort of softened, I think. How do you react to the fact that what was really a hot trend with modernist cuisine is now just a sort of a subplot?
Well, honestly, we spoke about this a bit yesterday, and my opinion was a little bit like the techniques that appeared back in the day when culinary was kind of evolving from chefs like Escoffier, Michel Roux, and people like that that created new techniques. Back in the day, the new techniques probably were seen like also like they are seen now, like people were overdoing them. And I think those molecular techniques, if you want to call them like that, they were overdone by chefs, and it became a little bit like they were covering up what would be real food, and people obviously got a bad impression of what it is. I think if you use it as a technique, a new or a current culinary technique, and you don't give emphasis to that technique, but you continue giving emphasis to the produce, which is what people actually appreciate and what they sit down for, I don't think there's nothing wrong with it. I just see it as a technique, and I use it. I think my approach to food is very creative, and I call, or we recognize, or we say that our food, or the food that I try to do, is aggressive, progressive, creative, whatever you want to call it. But it is really something that we want to push it as an aggressive approach to food that clashes with what people are expecting. It clashes with what people usually are in tuned with. So we are a little bit out of tune because we want to show what's different, and we want to show a different approach to food. And again, like what we were speaking yesterday, like restaurants, like what I would like to have, and a little bit what we do in Sushi Samba as well, is what brings people out of their homes to go and try something that cannot be replicated elsewhere, you know. And for us to keep on pushing those boundaries, and for us to evolve that way, not only we evolve ourselves as chefs, as human beings, as experts, as masters of what we're trying to achieve, but as well we are educating and showing to people possibilities. We're showing to them new things. We're giving them new experiences throughout our research.
Now, Sushi Samba was actually started in New York. And what is the corporate structure? I'm not sure I even know.
Well, the corporate structure is based in New York. Pretty much like any other company that develops and is broken down into a series of investors. A series of, obviously, you have the owners and the people that created the brand that are still the main people that own the brand, per se, but then you have several investors, and it then is broken down to different locations, and sometimes a different location has a different associate from that country, let's say, and that's a bit like it works, but it's founded in New York City, and it's from New York.
But you're opening other places in other cities. How extensive is this brand?
Well, it became to a point that now it's an international recognized brand. It was an American brand until it got to London. It had several locations, let's say New York, Vegas, Chicago, and two in Miami. Now it's down to, and it had two actually in New York as well. Now it's down to one in New York, one in Miami, and one in Vegas, with new restaurants opening in the U.S. as well. First would be in Miami, in the River, and it's a project that is in the Flagler, in the River in Miami, which is a pretty cool area, and it's a really nice restaurant. Then we have... obviously, in Europe, we're opening another one in London, in Covent Garden, which is opening this year in the summer. We're opening as well in Amsterdam, so that would be midway through the year. And we're opening as well Dubai. So those are the three, four openings that we're having, because obviously we're looking into having something significant in New York as well. And then there's various possibilities that I'm pretty sure we are looking into explore.
will they all be the same, or will there be room for difference? I think I can imply from what you already said that London is different than New York, and you made it that way. Are you going to make a new image in these new cities, or is it going to be more of a duplicate of what's here in London?
I believe every single restaurant we do, a little bit as the image of our owner and the main person behind the designs and the creativity in what is regards to the layout and different and the space of the different locations. So every single location of Sushi Samba is very different. All of them have the same kind of style, which is the graffiti, the street art a little bit blend with the luxurious chandeliers and stuff like that. So I know for a fact that Amsterdam is a very cleaner kind of restaurant, still with the street art and a little bit more approach to the Japanese, Dubai funkier, and I just believe that the brand is evolving in terms of what food is concerned. It will be very in line with what we do in London, because I will be doing the openings and I will be in charge of those restaurants in terms of creating their menus and kind of keeping an eye on whatever head chef is there. So I pretty much guess it will go in the same direction as creativity is as creativity concerns. But if what we're talking about design, London is very very London is very different from the other locations, but every location is supposed to be very different one from each other.
This is just in case you're wondering, that is really magnificently good news, because the food here is just a tad north of outrageously wonderfully good. Claudia, just in case you need another compliment.
Yeah, well, I'm with him. As I said, if I lived here, I'd be eating here all the time. I loved everything every time we had.
It was the best place to put an artist.
Yes. Now, I read that 50% of your recipes are what I would call corporate, and that they would be a standard set by, say, the original structure in New York. But then 50 of them are your own creation. Could you give me an idea of, like, I mean, this is by way of you're being very, very happy with the fact that you get latitude creatively to construct your own dishes. But just how about which would you view as more corporate and which do you claim to be your signatures at the London location?
Well, in terms of the 50-50, that works for the other locations. Around here is more 60-40. So I'm winning on the 60, and corporate recipes would be more 40%. Although I get a lot of complaints from, obviously, my boss, because I create different, I see food different. I'm glad that I have a great team here that kind of gives me the support that I need to kind of do that kind of food. And I think we overtook the corporate recipes mainly because of that. Okay. Then obviously those recipes that were created here became in a way corporate recipes, because then they were taken to other restaurants, being at Vegas or even Miami. So around here there's a few recipes that are ours, and when I say ours is mine with my team together. Some have way more input coming from me, like let's say 80-90% coming from me in terms of the first idea and the final idea. But then there's ideas that don't come entirely from me. There's some dishes on the menu that I had very little input in terms of what the dish started to be, and then the final input of how it becomes to be a bigger piece or more. Maybe we start out of a flavor that I didn't even put together, something simple, and then we end up elaborating something I think more interesting or more in tune to what I think is the style that I want to see things going with. But I think the team here, because we work for so long together, that they kind of absorb a bit the style, and even when they create, they already are in the same notes that what I create. So that's cool as well. A dish that I really like on this current menu from me is definitely the Kobe breakfast. So it's a dish that we have because we have... We are allowed to sell Kobe in the restaurant. We have a certificate. We are certified. There's not very restaurants that are allowed to serve certificate real Kobe. A lot of them serve Wagyu and they use the Kobe word because it has more emphasis on the sale. In our case, we use the Kobe. We are in the. We have the restorability from the moment. Let's say. From all the relatives of the cow that we are buying. So we get a certificate of the farmer, we get a certificate of the farm that we get that cow from, but we are certified by the Ministry of Agriculture of Japan to have the Kobe here being sold. So obviously they have to check my CV, they have to see how Sushi Samba is and came about to see if it's a place that they want to be attached with. And then you start selling Kobe. So the Kobe breakfast that we created, the idea was a little bit create an English breakfast around the Kobe. So it's beef, bacon, and beef sausage served with the elements that you would find in an English breakfast, but played differently. It's a piece of art with the elements, like, for example, it's a black bean puree that is on the plate, so it makes a black splash to start with. Then you have aji panko ketchup and aji amarillo mustard as a splash as well. You have a quail fried egg. You have the asparagus as a crudité. It has a crisp of mushrooms, and then it has a sausage of Kobe, the bacon of Kobe, and then it has a crisp of tomato. It is a very elegant and very pretty dish, so I really like it. On this menu, as flavors concern and presentation, one of the dishes that I would say would be more corporate, definitely the taquitos is something that a lot of restaurants do, but I think Sushi Samba might have been one of the first ones to start doing them. It started in Miami, so it's we have the Yellowtail taquitos. Okay. Was something that we started like long ago, let's say 15 years in Miami, as the restaurant in Miami started doing it, and then it became a very corporate recipe. In terms of corporate recipes, when I arrived, not that we changed recipes, I think we managed to perfect the recipes. We looked into the science of each recipe, and we just made it kind of better. Well, for example, if we were doing, let's say, a lobster stock, we would do a lobster bisque, so it would have more flavor, so it would announce the flavor of whatever we were doing with it. For example, we have a dish that we use egg white, and we have to pass a certain element through egg white. So the egg white was done from the morning, do a service, and then again the egg white was done for dinner service, so two times. What we started doing, we put the egg white in a canister, so it's always fresh and fluffy when we pass it through. Obviously, it's more time-consuming, but you see the result in the final recipe. So that's what we try to really look into, is look in the steps of each recipe and just try to improve them and make them better.
Can you just, our listeners love to hear the pornographic details of food. Can you select something else that we had that we liked all of it and run us through the unique characteristics of it?
How about those green beans?
Yeah, I mean, you sort of move everything up to a whole different level, like the tempura green beans. I mean, I've had those in 10 million restaurants. But you have it with a black truffle aioli, and they're very light. Tell us about that.
I think to start with, green bean is a Portuguese dish. So it was the dish that actually took tempura to Japan. So the Portuguese, then when they were sailing to Japan, threw out the green bean tempura. We took it to Japan, and they started applying that to other elements. The reason why the green bean tempura came about in Portugal, we used to call it fish from the farm. Reason being is because people that weren't close to the sea, they didn't have the chance or possibility to eat fish, because obviously back in the day there wasn't any way of preserving fish except for salting. So they wouldn't eat fresh fish. And a way to apply to eat kind of the fried fish that they were eating in the coast with the batter was to batter green bean and kind of have them and call them the fish from the farm, because they would apply the same frying technique. So that was the way that Portuguese then took the fried green bean to Japan. So the reason why I think ours is better, because it's a Portuguese dish, no? Kind of. I understand what you're saying. I think... Yeah, the black truffle aisle. Well, the truffle, the truffle is our black truffle aioli. Even the aioli compared to other restaurants, the difference is just one shot of that aioli that comes with the dish is almost probably half of the price of the dish, let's say, you know, because we use real truffle, we put a lot of truffle, and we emulsion it with truffle oil instead of any other oil. So we don't make it cheap, we make it expensive, but we get the outcome on flavor. And that's what we try to look at, you know. There's no cutting corners here. We are an expensive restaurant per se, but we are in an expensive area with an exclusive restaurant, and we use top products. And sometimes when people think that, oh, this is a rip-off, no, you having the best produce. Some of your fish actually flew yesterday from Japan, and you having something that not everyone can have. So obviously it's a bit selective on the wallets, but it's also very selective produce, and that has a price.
Now, what was the concluding sushi dish we had? It had crab, it had it was in the S-shape for the sushi samba.
So what you had was the tiger maki. Tiger maki with the takuan, the wasabi, tobiko, the crab meat, the tempura prawn. It has also a yogurt pinkish dressing with beetroot and the soy reduction.
Yes.
So that's the one. That's that's the tiger maki. It's really good. It's one of my favorites. I have it quite often as one of the sushis that is not so corporate. It's actually it's a signature from London. It's a really awesome roll. It's, I think, one of our top sellers as well.
We had so much fun with your dessert. Talk to us about this dessert. Oh, and the little rake.
The desserts, we have a really fun menu. Our menu with what says or what concerns desserts is really funky and really cool. Also, I have a good background with pastry, and I'm very creative what comes to desserts, and I believe that desserts are the final touch and something that is memorable, and as we can see, like, even you can remember it really well from yesterday, right? Our desserts, and the way I see it, desserts you always can play a lot in terms of creating landscapes, right? Mainly because you can use any color almost possible in desserts, that it doesn't come wrong. If you use a purple, you can always relate to a blueberry, you can relate to a lot of things that are more associated to desserts. So desserts are easier to play in terms of landscaping and shapes and funky colors. So the dessert you had yesterday is, we call it the Zen Garden. It's pretty much, it's a Japanese garden. It comes with a rake and a design on the sand. It comes with two stones that are pretty much a shell, and inside one has a peach sorbet, and the other one as a lychee kind of sauce. You have as well poppy candy that are hiding beneath the vanilla ice cream and the tea cookies. It has a curd that is made with yuzu as well. So it is a playful dessert. It is very pretty as well. It is eye-catching, mainly. It's something that I always say food is supposed to nowadays. You take a picture and you mix everything and you eat it. That's a perfect case of that dish right there. So, yeah, I think in desserts and what it concerns the dessert, you actually tried that dessert, but we have another dessert that we're actually doing now for a charity we're doing with the Peruvian Amazon, some of the tribes, Chinka tribes, and we're doing a dessert that's called Welcome to the Rainforest. So that Welcome to the Rainforest comes inside of a cocoa pod, and then it's almost like a landscape of the rainforest. So as you open the cocoa pod, it has a landscape of the Amazon with little roots and plants and flowers, and it has the flavors that you would find from that tribe, which is the cocoas, the coffees, the vanillas, and obviously those produce comes from those tribes. So we're kind of trying to also have a little bit of impact, not only in those communities, but as well in the planet, because by avoiding the rainforest to be devastated and obviously the trees being cut down just because those tribes struggled to have an economy of their own, we can kind of support their economy so they avoid to sell their land, and we manage to have a little bit more oxygen in our planet while we're still around.
Well, we haven't even mentioned the pork belly, which was superb, and we there's so many things that we haven't mentioned, just everything was wonderful, and the staff really makes this meal. They're so well trained, they're exceptional, and And your song is brilliant.
We at this level, and people, when they come to a place like this, the expectation is up there. People are spending good money. They wait so long to get a reservation here. Our waiting list is for 2 months. So imagine if you book, you're 2 months waiting for a meal at a restaurant. You expect nothing more than having a great meal, a great experience, and being treated like you should be treated for a person that waited 2 months to actually get a booking in our restaurant, you know. And I don't expect nothing the less. And I think when we work in a certain level, we cannot drop our guard in terms of service, because service can save a meal, you know. Service is the first and the last almost engagement, let's say, and it's what can save a dining experience. So that's why you have to have great people doing a great job and representing what we try to create in the back. They try to represent it in the front in the best way possible, and that's what we expect.
And of course, the views are, you know, gorgeous. The decor is not today; it's very foggy. Surprise, surprise! But the decorations for the holidays, the ceiling with it—I just couldn't even imagine having to decorate that, considering how to place every single bulb or every shiny bulb seems to be on purpose and specific. Altogether, it is a total dining experience par excellence, and I can't thank you enough. Thank you, and you're doing a wonderful job.
Thank you, and obviously it's an honor to have you again at Sushi Samba. You know that you're more than welcome. We have some things planning maybe for this year, and hopefully everything goes the right way. It will be a busy year, but we will keep obviously in touch, and you're more than welcome to come back and enjoy the same experience, hopefully. And, well, just let me know, and hopefully I'll be around.
How cool is that?
He's cool.
You end an interview by being invited back. and Claudio is going to be opening new Sushi Samba restaurants in two or three different places
in
the next 12 months. So wouldn't be surprised if we manage to catch up.
Pop up in Miami.
More than one of those places.
Yeah.
Anyway, another interesting adventure, and only two stories away from where we were interviewing Claudio. Is another fascinating dining experience and a fascinating young chef right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. In the same building, as Peter said, there is, it's not in the city that never sleeps, because it's in London, but it is the restaurant that never sleeps. I always wanted to come sneak in there at 3 a.m. And we're going to talk to Dan Daugherty about Duck and Waffle.
Here's a funny one for you. The night before we went back to interview Dan, we were actually watching a sport program, which unfortunately Peter is prone to do. But sports personalities from around the world were gathered in London for a very special set of awards. And Andy Murray won for the best athlete overall in the United Kingdom. Michael Phelps was in the audience, and we didn't find out why until he received an award for being the world's most celebrated athlete, the world's most celebrated athlete. And Leicester City Football Club won as the best team award. And I'll bet, although Dan wouldn't tell us, that both Michael Phelps and Leicester City were probably at Duck and Waffle sometime during the night after they got their awards. He wouldn't say so. But he said they don't kiss and tell, but I'll bet, because it's the kind of place they would go to have fun. And, of course, we went there to have fun, too. You can have fun there any time of the day or night.
We talked to Chef Dan Daugherty. We figured out it must have been 2.5 years ago. But we're back at Duck and Waffle. And you've been doing a lot since last we talked, Chef Dan. First, let's start with, just to catch our listeners up, describe Duck and Waffle, the place and the menu.
Okay, so the restaurant itself is still the same beast, as it were. It's, you know, a 24-hour restaurant, literally open 24 hours a day. It's we serve in that time up to 1,000-1,200 covers. So it's a busy place. That's breakfast, brunch, lunch, dinner, overnight, all of those sort of things. And the style of food is really difficult to describe, and I like that. I like that it's not something you can put in a pigeonhole. I think saying something's modern Italian or classic British, it does limit you somewhat. Whereas I think the menus eclectic, but still contained within strong British and European roots. But what it means is that we're free to cook however we want. So we're not, you know, if we get a delivery of cuttlefish, we don't have to say, okay, we're Northern Italians, it has to be done X, Y, Z. We can just say, well, let's go a little bit Asian. And I think now, after 4.5 years that we've been open, people are, they come here knowing that there is kind of something for everyone, but it's also, there's always going to be some surprises in there as well. So, you know, we've got a corn dog on the menu. Pork and apple corn dog with chipotle mayonnaise. Now, corn dogs, obviously, you know, popular in America. They're not really being explored over here. And then it's not a sausage. It's braised pork shoulder with lots of apple, lots of vinegar and sugar. So it's kind of sweet and sour. And we roll that into a cylinder, dip it in cornbread batter, and then fry it. So it's not a sausage. It's braised meat coated in corn. And then it's with a chipotle mayonnaise. So nice and smoky and spicy, but some lime in there as well. Coriander, all those kind of vibes. So where you would say that's from, I've got no idea, but I think it kind of reflects the, with the ox cheek donut as well, it reflects the kind of style of the restaurant. Yeah, so that's it. I think that's, you know, it's very difficult to describe a restaurant in a nutshell, but that's my attempt.
Well, you've got a lot of different influences on here, as you were describing. You seem to have an affinity for such things as miso glazed rabbit, which you wouldn't expect on a breakfast menu. But I think that you probably have managed to luck out in being right on trend with the importance of breakfast, no matter what time of the day you order it, right?
That's correct. That the rabbit's not on the breakfast menu. This is the breakfast menu. But now you've said it, I'm actually tempted to put it on. This is our all. So the all day menu runs from 11:30 a.m. right the way through till midnight, and then our late night menu kicks in. Our breakfast menu is from 6 a.m. till 10:30 a.m. And you know that I think the breakfast is so important, and I think it's a service that's been neglected for a long, long time. Especially over here. I think in America and Canada and Australia, those and New Zealand, those countries have really nailed it for a while now. I think they've realized the importance of breakfast and how it's a great opportunity business-wise, but it's also fun and it's social and it's approachable, it's relaxed, it's laid back. So I think being inspired, you know, going over to those countries and being inspired by that has led us to really kind of drive it. And ultimately, you want your restaurant to be busy and full right from the, I mean, we never close, but right from the moment you open, you know, it's such a beautiful atmosphere when the sun's rising and you're eating maybe an ox cheek Benedict or a waffle.
We're talking about the sun rising. Where are we? Talk about the location and these grand views.
So we are the highest restaurant in the UK from the ground up. We often get challenged by cafes on top of mountains and things like this, but we're not, you know, the highest in the world, like, as in height, but from the floor up. And we basically, on top of this skyscraper that we're on, we built a glass box, and inside that glass box, we put a couple of restaurants. So we have Sushi Samba on the 38th floor. The middle floor is a late night bar, a private dining space, that kind of thing, also run by Sushi Samba. And then on the top floor is Duck and Waffle, which, you know, we're looking at now through the glass because it's an L shape, and we're sat in the bar, and it's kind of panoramic wraparound views all the way around the building. And you can see, you know, looking, I mean, it's a bit of a foggy day today, but if you look this way, you've got Shoreditch and the East End of London going on to, you know, Dalston and Stratford. And if you look over there, you've got Canary Wharf in the distance, huge towers, Tower Bridge, you've got the Gherkin, you know, and then it's just the same all the way around. And you're kind of, you find yourself looking out and you think, oh, that's you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's kind of subtle little nudges as to realizing what things are, you know, because it does look quite, it's vast, you know, and it's just lots and lots of buildings. And when you actually sit there and focus, you can kind of work out where you are and where you live and all those things. It is fun.
You know, I've always wanted to sneak in here at 3 a.m. to find out who's in here. Who's in here at 3 a.m.?
You should definitely sneak in at 3 a.m. I think it, on a Friday and a Saturday night, between midnight and 5 in the morning, we'll do 300 to 400 dining covers. You know, that's a big chunk of people. And I think at that time of day, it's the best reflection of the demographic of London you'll ever see, other than the Tube. The Tube is also, you go to a Tube carriage and, you know, try and guess where people are from or what they do, and it could be a billionaire, it could be a poor person, you know, whatever. But in the dining room, you look across and you'll have a group of footballers there, you'll have some, like, TV, reality TV stars, then you'll have a couple of, you'll have some hipsters, you'll have some older couples, some younger couples, you'll have, you know, all of these different crowds of people that just reflects how diverse and wonderful London is, and it just goes all the way through the night, and it's insane. People will turn up at 4 a.m., sit down, order a bottle of wine, have a lovely meal, and then pay and leave, you know, and it's not a club, and it's not, you know, it's fun, but it's certainly not a drinking thing. It's a 24-hour restaurant.
We were watching a BBC's Sports People of the Year on TV last night. It went on for a very long time, but there were a lot of interesting people there. We didn't find out until very late why Michael Phelps was there, and Leicester City won the Club of the Year. I wonder if any of those people come in afterwards, you know?
We don't kiss and tell, but it's the good thing about Duck and Waffle is I think people feel, regardless of fame or whatever, you know, celebrity status, people feel comfortable to come here knowing that, okay, if it's 4 o'clock in the morning and someone's had a few drinks on the next day, well, they may ask for a picture, but generally the staff certainly respect the privacy. And often, you know what is really hard is it's very difficult to actually recognize these people in real life. You know, what you see on TV, you think you would get them, but often people walk straight past you and you're like, you know, my girlfriend would tell, that was blah blah blah, and you're like, really? They all look so different. Honestly, I don't know if they came last night, but I'd like to think they don't tell.
You are not only chefing a lot, you also have become a significant author. We talked to you just before your first book came out. Tell us about that one. It's a Duck and Waffle cookbook.
Well, the first book is called Recipes and Stories, and it's exactly that. It's a reflection of the restaurant, told through some of our signature dishes, lots of dishes that were on the menu for a short amount of time, but we wanted to kind of let them live on for a lot longer, so we put them in the book. Some new things as well, and then the stories aspect is partly the stories behind the dishes and why we do things and where the dishes come from and, you know, what, why, and where. And secondly, there's stories about how the restaurant became to be a restaurant, and you know, about the Shimon Bukovza, who's a wonderful, wonderful man, who created the whole kind of visionary concept of having a 24-hour restaurant in a part of the city which is renowned for being dead at night. So it's recipes and stories, and then we've just released another one. It's a mouthful. It's called Toast, Hash, Roast, Mash. And the reason that the name is so vague is because the food is, I think, it's focusing on, I guess, breakfasty brunch-style food that's, I think, perfectly acceptable to eat all through the day. So I think I'm more than happy to have savory, you know, dinner food for breakfast, whether that's steak and eggs or whatever, or vice versa, having breakfast dishes in the evening. You know, there's nothing wrong, I don't think, with having eggs in the evening. And then it just kind of goes on to talk about pancakes and hashes and hangover food and side dishes. There's a big focus on side dishes because I think, you know, often people think, okay, I'm going to have chicken for dinner, but what should I have with it? And that's, you know, I think having a bit of variety there is helpful. So, and it's been really well received. I'm really, really lucky to have a great team.
Is there a push in Britain for the... or push back against the rise of the vegetable forward and vegan menus?
Whether there is or not, I don't think we have a choice. I think, you know, especially with dietaries and stuff like that, we have to be all encompassing. Our menu is a third fish, third meat, third vegetables. You know, I think you have to be all encompassing, and you have to give people a reason to still come to your restaurant. I feel very strongly about taking allergies and stuff seriously. So we've come up with a gluten and dairy-free waffle, so people can have our signature dish without having to have potatoes with it or something. What I don't massively support is lifestyle choices. So if someone's a vegetarian, that's a lifestyle choice. There's no difference to going to a vegetarian restaurant and expecting a meat dish, because that's my lifestyle choice. And I think there's, at the restaurant, we're all encompassing and we do support everything and everything and everything. However, myself personally, I think, you know, if you come and you're allergic to gluten, we've made you a gluten-free waffle. You're allergic to dairy, we've also made you a dairy-free waffle. You're allergic to both, we've made both. The vegetarian thing, I think, is a lifestyle choice, and it's we do our best to put as many vegetable dishes on the menu, but where do you stop if you allow, you know, I don't like onions. Okay, brilliant. So now we take out. You know, you'll be left with a menu of ingredients that people make their own meals from. So it's, I think we have to tread very, very carefully.
Yeah, there was a headline about don't let vegans bully us or something in yesterday's paper.
You know, there's some wise thought behind that. And I think one shouldn't be obnoxious or arrogant and say, you know, we don't feed vegans or we don't cook for vegetarians. That's absolutely ridiculous. But what we also should not be bullied, because they are lifestyle choices. And it's, you know, if I have kids, they will eat, I'll make sure they eat everything, you know, and then they can make their lifestyle choice. But what they don't do is inflict that upon other people. And I think it's a very grey area that needs to be, I think we should be accommodating and hospitable, but also not be bullied for sure.
Now, in addition to your writing and your books, you've done a fair number of pop-ups, which seems to be what chefs do, and festivals, which chefs also do. I mean, I don't know what else you could add to and still be able to have a life with all the stuff chefs are expected to do. But one of the things you were talking about, that MTV, of course, but one of the things you were talking about is the mentorship program that you're involved with. Tell us about the Young Chefs mentorships.
Well, the overall project is called the Tomorrow Project, and that consists of three different things. So the first thing is Chefs of Tomorrow, and that's doing a series of dinners throughout the year where we get four young chefs, young in their career, not young by age, to cook with each other to create an evening for people who buy tickets for it. So they get a kind of a day in the life experience of creating a dish, being mentored, working with one another, going out and talking to guests afterwards. And you know, there's also lateral mentorship where they're mentoring one another. So that's that side of it. And then we have the front of house aspect, which is called the switch, which is where for 1 week a year we get lots of different restaurants and we get them to switch one person from their front of house with another restaurant that's completely different. So take, you know, someone who works in a Chinese fine dining restaurant and put them in an English style bistro, or take someone from a three Michelin star restaurant and put them in a high paced brasserie.
Is this different from the Julina's chef swap?
I guess so, because it's front of house. I mean, the thing was is that Chef of Tomorrow was getting lots of attention and lots of support, and actually front of house needs more help, I think. So we were trying to think of a different scheme to get front of house people talking and caring and thinking more about their jobs and about the career possibilities by going front of house and taking it seriously. So we thought, why don't we just get them out of their comfort zone? So 24-hour restaurant, 1,000 covers a day, into a one Michelin star restaurant in the countryside. And they just do it for a week, and then they write about it, they take pictures, they do blogs, and then we put it all on our website, and so on and so forth. And then the third aspect of it is doing talks, which we want to challenge uncomfortable subjects. So we did a panel, so there was four people, so the former editor of The Independent, editor of Delicious Magazine, a Michelin star head chef, all women, and got them on a panel and got them to discuss women in the industry, and is it still taboo, and is there an issue, and what challenges have you faced? And it packed out, 60 people all in a room saying, actually, you know, I'm a woman in the industry, and I'm inspired by you because you edit a Sunday newspaper, which is huge, the one newspaper of the year. What challenges have you had? Is this normal? You know, and questioning things. And then we're going to do some on bullying in the workplace, and we've done it on an interesting one was called Cooking the Books, and it's nothing to do with tax fraud, but I think it's interesting how years ago, certainly when I started cooking, people got into cooking because they weren't particularly academic. Then they became very, very good at cooking, opened their own restaurant, and then now they're running a business. Now they need to be academic. And often they don't have those skills, or they've had to learn them. You know, you were running away from something, and you've been pulled back into it through something you love. So discussing being a chef, also being business savvy, and making the right decisions, and taking risks, and you know, X, Y, and Z. So it's been an interesting year, and we've just finished planning for next year, and we've got four panels, four Chefs of Tomorrow dinners, and then the week of the switch, which is really exciting.
I really don't understand where you find the time, but you seem, since the last time I talked to you, to be in a much more secure place. How do you explain that? You seem really goal-driven and definite and positive.
That's a very difficult question to answer. I do feel good. You know, I think maybe after a couple of years, you get a clear idea of what you want to do, and things settle down a bit. I think opening this restaurant was incredibly hard. And when we spoke to you, if it was before the book came out, then it had been probably the busiest 18 months of my life. And, you know, we were working crazy hours and still trying to figure out who we were. You know, we opened this restaurant not knowing what we were meant to be doing. You know, we were like, we had a rough idea of the food we wanted to cook, but now I'm personally very comfortable with the fact that that's eclectic, and it's a bit different, and it's not you know, a certain type of stuff. But I guess maybe then there was the insecurity of it, not really knowing if that was the right thing to do. Do we need to make it a certain genre, for a better explanation? And maybe that's just kind of settled down now. And I think after 4.5 years, there's a confidence that comes with that, which is that we are doing a good job, and that people like what we do, because okay, there's a great view, but I like to think they're coming for the food as well. So, yeah, that's it, really.
Now, I'm a little bit miffed about the next thing, as you have all kinds of good things in the works, but you can't talk about them. When would you be able to talk about them?
Well, we do have lots of things on the go. Hopefully, in the new year, we'll be able to share some exciting news. But you know how it is with these things, they can always change, and we don't want to disappoint anyone, so we just want to make sure we've got all of our ducks in a line and get everything ready to go. And then once, you know, hopefully we'll have some great news to share. I'm hoping so.
All of your ducks and your waffles.
Exactly, get them all in the line.
Well, it's great talking to you again, and I wish you continued success. I mean, here it is on, is it a Monday today?
Monday,
and it's 11 o'clock in the morning, and the place is buzzing, and it goes 24 hours like this. Dan, you're amazing. Thank you so much for taking out time to talk to us.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you for coming back as well.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, and now to a new restaurant and an old friend. It's called, what is it called?
Yosem, and I think Greg tried to explain that to us.
Greg Taylor is the chef we interviewed, because Hoos wasn't in.
But it's an operation headed up by a young man with a very interesting name, Hoos Vedat, who is ethnically Turkish from the island of Cyprus. And when we last met him, he was cooking for Jamie Oliver at Jamie Oliver's restaurant, Barbacoa.
Yes.
So
people get around, don't they?
They do, and of course, it happens in any major city. One of the things that I think probably surprises most people when they go to London for the first time, whether dining or traveling around or just looking at people in the street, is that London is an extraordinarily ethnically diverse city, and it has been an ethnically diverse city since 50 years BC,
yeah,
when the first overseas visitors included Julius Caesar. Uh-huh. But there's room for restaurants of every persuasion, and
there are restaurants, yeah, just about every
person. Hoos's ethnicity is Turkish, so his restaurant Yosem is Turkish, and we'll find out some more about what that means.
Yosma. I get
it all mixed up. Greg is a sous chef, and he stood in for Hoos and did a fine job of explaining what it was
we
were having.
He's worked with him for a long time, or before.
Is that right? Yeah. Okay. Super. Okay. Well, here's the story of
Yozma.
the answer to the question, of course, is elementary, my dear Watson, because we are on Baker Street, just a little down the road from 22B, where our friends took up residence in the 19th century. We're in the 21st century, and Sherlock would need to be consulted as to why there is a Turkish restaurant called Yozma right on this very street. But Greg's going to tell us all about that. Greg Taylor, who's the sous chef here, tell us about the concept behind Yozma.
So Yozma is a celebration of Turkish food, particularly Istanbul. My head chef, Hus, executive chef Hus, is the founder of the restaurant, and he wanted to bring the flavours that he grew up with into London and done in a particular way. So we cook using charcoal and wood, and we serve traditional Turkish dishes, but with a very modern London twist, and we have a restaurant that reflects that. So we have old butcher's tiles from Istanbul, a nice open-air space with a cool bar. And
now, there's a lot of lamb on the menu. There's a lot of yogurt in the dishes. So there are a series of ingredients that are perhaps a little bit unusual to the Western diner. Talk to us about some of those assemblages that you think are the things that you think best represent Yozma.
So we have two, what I could call signature dishes here, that are sort of our flagship dishes. The first is the Ali Nazik. So that's a lamb rump that's slow cooked over charcoal and wood. So nice and pink in the middle with cold roasted aubergines. So aubergines we cook in the fire, and they're mixed together with traditional thick Turkish yogurt, lemon juice, and some garlic. And that's served with a burnt tomato and a burnt Turkish pepper, which is extremely traditional in Turkey. You have that every single meal. You have your tomato and your pepper on the side of every single meal. And the other dish we do is manta, which is probably one of Istanbul's biggest dishes, if not the biggest dish. So it's tiny, tiny, tiny dumplings filled with lamb meat. And we put lamb neck in ours, extremely tender lamb neck. And so we cook off these little dumplings and serve it with a room temperature yogurt with some burnt chili butter. So butter we put nice and slowly with Turkish chili flakes inside. And then on top we have sumac, which is a ground down berry. Extremely fragrant, fruity, little bit of spice in it. Dried mint, and then parsley oil. So lots and lots of colour, lots of different flavours that all complement each other extremely well.
I love the calamari. I mean, I eat calamari every place I go, but this one was rather special. Tell us what the preparation was.
So the calamari we get in is fresh every day. They're enormous calamari. They're very, very, very tender, almost like butter. And we fry it in chickpea flour. So chickpeas are what people make hummus with. And we use like roasted and ground down chickpeas for our flour, which means it's gluten-free as well. So gluten-free is a big thing these days. So it means people can enjoy our calamari, but not feel guilty about it. And then on the side, we have our squid ink tarator. So it's a very simple, like, little dipping sauce of squid ink, tahini, and lime juice.
Now, we drank sparkling water, but people clearly drink things different than that. In a Turkish restaurant on Baker Street, we noticed some conventional red wine coming out, but what other things would people drink if they were really being Turkish?
So, in Turkey, they have a drink called raki, which is, it's like an aniseedy grape, drink. Extremely fragrant, botanical, there's lots of dill, mint, slight, nuances inside. And in Turkey, you eat and drink. You don't just drink, you eat and drink. So they would sip raki very, very slowly, diluted with water, which turned to a cloudy white colour. And over there they call it lion's milk. And so you eat for hours and you drink for hours. And you're supposed to drink raki and talk about your life and business with friends, and everyone gets upset, everyone makes up again. I actually had some this week, and I'm not used to it, so it took me a long time to recover. It was very, very heavy.
You have an extremely modern cooking device with a funny name like Jasper. Where does that fit in?
So the Jasper is a charcoal oven grill combination. Christopher Datt was actually one of the first people to bring it into cooking in London. And so you fill this giant cube of stainless steel full of charcoal. It gets extremely hot. And so you can grill things on a heavy grill, and it's a combination oven as well. So it cooks things very quickly, very high heat, and it smokes them as well. So it's an incredible piece of machinery. It's amazing.
So this is a modern touch. The Turks would have done it just a little differently, I guess.
Yeah, the whole concept of Yosma is to bring Turkish food into the 21st century, to try and modernize it, make it cool, and do things a little bit differently using techniques that have been established in London.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for talking to us. You didn't even know we were coming, so we really appreciate you stepping up ad hoc to talk about the Yosma experience, and it's starting to sound a little Turkish in the background right now. I'm expecting maybe there'll be a belly dancer coming out soon.
It's in the pipeline, yeah. We're trying to sort it out.
Well, we have one more London surprise for you next week. We're going to keep it as a surprise because that's what surprises are for. But it's another interesting food establishment that we found out that just opened not so long ago, that if you're into delicious desserts, there's a place you definitely will want to stop by. But you're going to have to wait until next week to find out where it is. So there.
Right.
And until then, when we hope you'll join us same time, same place, we are going to say goodbye.
Bye-bye.